Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast from the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. And it's Inauguration Day as we record this, the day we officially acknowledge the new Pantone color swatch in chief. Here to help me celebrate, or mourn, depending on their viewpoints, are some perhaps future presidents of these United States. I give you Adam Irwood.
Present.
I give you Rob Humble.
Good afternoon.
Kylie Miller is here.
Greetings, Earthlings.
And John Pienta is here as always, ready to speak his mind.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming. Appreciate that. Hey, we got a lovely message just this morning from listener Takia. God only knows what her name is. It's not like she told me.
Hi, my name's Takia, and I was just calling to say thank you for all the show stuff that you do. I'm listening to this Friday morning, the inauguration, and I'm actually packing. I'm sex educator at Planned Parenthood, and you guys, your laughs are so great. Just helps me stay really relaxed. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Damn. That is among the best compliments that we've ever gotten. I mean, if we are responsible for relaxing you on this inauguration day as you pack, I'm assuming that you're on your way to the Women's March, because I did, I do get a location from your voicemail. I do know approximately where your phone number is from, and I'm assuming that your Planned Parenthood is in the D.C. area, given what I saw. So maybe, I'm hoping you're on your way towards the Women's March in D.C. today or tomorrow, and that's what you're packing for. And not that you've been fired and you're packing your office. Maybe you're going on a tropical vacation, for all I know. But I'm going to choose to believe that you're on your way to Washington, D.C. And before I throw it open to you guys, thank you for what you do.
Yeah, I was going to say, thanks for all the education. Keep it up. Don't let anyone bring you down. You're doing great things that we need to continue doing.
There you go.
I'd like to second that.
Yes, it's important on the podcast that we observe Robert's rules of order.
Procedure matters.
We have the very Robert himself right here with us today.
Robert's rules of order. So my wife is actually on her way to D.C. today to participate. As I said goodbye to her this morning, I suggested that she keep her eyes open. Keep your wits about you, because you're going to be in a big crowd of people. I hope she has a good time, I guess, because that's what you do at protest marches. Just have a good time.
Yeah. Is she going to be part of the Bucket Brigade?
What's that? Bucket Brigade.
So I had some friends who are really into protests that got... So the Bucket Brigade are people who come and carry, like, they carry steel, like, mop buckets. Mm-hmm. So that when the police shoot tear gas, you run real quick towards the tear gas and you flip the bucket upside down
on top of the...
and then stand on it so the tear gas can't get out. But it's...
I'm hoping
they get hot, so
I'm hoping
it's got to be a metal bucket.
Yeah. I'm hoping this isn't that kind of protest.
There were people breaking windows this morning right before the inauguration started, and the D.C. police were like, I think pepper spraying them.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Don't break windows.
Yeah, don't Man. Break windows.
That's dumb.
It's going to take place tomorrow, so hopefully the...
I think Trump hired them. Fake news brought to you here first on the Short Coat. Trump hired them to break windows so that this looks... They make the liberals look bad.
Yeah. Well, good luck to all of the world. And thank you. I do love when we get messages from listeners. First of all, it validates what we do, and I feel like Takiya in particular saying that we are relaxing her on this day of days is really super sweet.
Is it therapeutic for you that we are therapeutic for her?
It is.
Me too.
God. All this external validation gives me the feels.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time most of the time in life, we have to depend on internal motivations, internal validations for everything that we do. And when you get an external signal that you're doing the right thing, man, that feels way better than telling yourself that you're doing good work.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
That symmetry is important. You know, that for that balance of, when the external validates what you've felt.
Right. I agree.
Moral of the story, surround yourself with validating people
yeah.
who know your worth.
Or lots of mirrors.
But try not to get into a bubble. And second, it means that I have to work less when putting together a show, which I appreciate because we can talk about what you want to discuss. And not just have me make stuff up. So call us at 347-SHORT-CT. Visit us at theshortcoat.com/tell us. There's a bunch of ways to get in touch with us. And thank God for that, because we got an email from Liza, who has noticed that medicine seems to be an inheritable trait.
I'm a new listener to the podcast, just started while driving a bunch this break, and I love it. Because of this, I don't know if you have ever covered this topic or not. I have noticed, after getting to know a lot of my classmates for the first time, that many of them come from MD parents. This struck me because I and my cousin, who is also in our class, are the first people in my family, as far back as I can go, who had anything to do with the medical community. No doctors, no nurses, no administrators, nothing. I just thought it was an interesting observation and could be a cool conversation topic.
And that is why I am joined today by, two sets of people, as I said before, Adam and John, they are here, and they happen to be from medical families. And Rob and Kylie are from non-medical student family. And in Kylie's case, maybe Rob's case, I don't know, but Kylie is like a first generation, like higher education type.
Yes, first to go to college.
I think that's not true for you.
Correct.
Okay. So anyway, what are the differences between medical families and non-medical families when it comes to being a medical student? What do you guys think? Because I don't know.
I think this is something that's come up with friends, like both, like on either side of this discussion. And I think like one of the things that comes up frequently is that there's like this, a sense of uncertainty, like, because we don't have an in-house resource to go to in terms of how this process works, you don't really know what you don't know, and you can try. I mean, you read up and you talk to people, and that's all fine and good. But you like it, there is an added uncertainty of like, I don't know if this is gonna work out.
Right, right. What about you, Kylie? What?
Yeah, I think it was always a bit of, like, a source of bitterness for me, kind of, that I thought other kids had it a lot easier.
But what isn't a source of bitterness for you?
Right? Yeah. Some people call me salty here. And,
yeah, you're salty.
I just need more sleep.
I just thought that's because you liked cured meats.
No, those are carcinogenic. Right?
Don't you remember
that study?
No, they're not.
I'm gonna keep eating them regardless.
Flawed medicine.
Yes. Well, I just definitely thought that they, like, knew the secrets that I didn't know, or that I had to work 10 times harder to get here than other people perhaps. But like, once you get to know everyone, it's really hard by just looking at somebody. Like, I wouldn't have known that Adam had doctors for parents. I knew there was something weird about John, but like, I wasn't sure that's what it was. But at the same time, I was kind of grateful. It made me more tenacious about learning for myself if this was really what I wanted, and finding things for myself, what drew me to the field. Connecting with other students. I know there's a lot of online forums. It became a source of kind of camaraderie with other people, and a source of like knowledge and community. So I don't know. There's good things to draw from both sides.
In all fairness, when Adam first came to the College of Medicine, he was advised, you know, not to wear his surgical mask. that he inherited from his family.
Yes, but he is wearing his Gulfstream polo, I will add.
This is a really comfortable polo. Okay, so
Adam used to work there.
And his pinkies up.
Yeah.
So Adam, let's start with you then, because Adam is not just from a family that has a doctor in it. He's from a family that has all doctors in it, apparently. They're all doctors. Everybody yep. from, like, the, you know, they got, he, his family got off the freaking Mayflower with a stethoscope in their hand
and checked the Native Americans for vitals correct.
Signs, yeah. So tell us about your family.
Yeah, my parents both have MDs. They actually both went to Iowa. And then I've got two brothers who are in residency, neurosurgical, one near the tail end of residency, one near the beginning. And then my sister's an M2 down in Atlanta. So my younger brother wants to be a vet. So we do have a little bit of difference, but for the most part.
So he doesn't get to talk at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, basically.
He just takes vitals on the turkey.
I know it's hard to see from within what the privileges of being in a, or what the benefits of being in a medical family are, but what do you think were the benefits?
There really aren't that many benefits to having parents that are in the field, at least for me. I mean, I barely even knew what my parents did growing up. I had no idea what a neurosurgeon really did. I didn't even think it was that big a deal. I remember calling my dad all the time to ask him what was for dinner in the middle of a surgery, and nurses would pick up the phone and I'd be like, "Dad, why aren't you home? What is for dinner?" And he would just answer it. But yeah,
brains.
So that just shows that I had little clue.
So but going
it really does help with siblings being in it, like especially my sister being in med school, because having somebody write the next step who really knows and what they did at that step, you know, that's very useful.
She's a nice lady. Shout out to Adam's sister. Met her while tailgating.
Amelie. Are we not going to mention her name?
Can we mention Amelie?
Yep. Did you ever feel that there was like expectations for you to go into medicine because you are surrounded by lots of people that are in medicine?
Not really. So me and my sister and brother are all from like non-traditional routes in terms of majors as well. We all wanted to do something else. Engineering, and then all three different engineering backgrounds, and then kind of made the switch my junior year of college. And so I like in that way there wasn't really much pressure. If anything, there was a pressure to do something different because everybody else was doing it. And I don't know, from that, just like when you tell people and they're like, "Oh, of course you're going into medicine," and it's like, well, that stinks.
And what does your mom do?
My mom is actually a resident right now. She practiced OB-GYN and then stopped when she started having kids. And so she's in her 60s and is in her family medicine residency right now.
That is awesome.
Yeah, how crazy is that?
So, wow.
So did she stay home?
We're a bunch
of
masochists,
when
basically.
You were younger?
Yeah, she stayed at home. Mm-hmm.
John, what's your story?
That also, what Adam just said reminds me of my friend's mom was an ER doc for like forever. Mm-hmm. And then she reboarded in addiction medicine, like in her late 50s or her 60s.
Yeah.
But
that happens.
I think that's cool though. You know, like she found that she really liked working with the people who came in, you know, like in that sort of like teachable moment. You know, they had a drug overdose or something. And then you get a little of the psychiatry sort of counseling and you get a little bit of medicine taking care of them. So she started like a primary care clinic for people who have drug addiction, which is really interesting. But anyway, the big thing for me is now that my mom since my mom is a doctor, all of the passive aggressive statements about not studying enough have a "I'm a doctor" bent to them.
Wait a minute.
So like, shouldn't you be studying now? Those kinds of statements. Uh-huh. Like, I studied more when I was doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that.
But there's downsides, is what you're saying.
You know, no, I tried. I you know, take it for what it's worth. It's that's fun.
Did you get so?
I tried really hard not to go into medicine.
Did you? Yeah. Well, yeah. You.
I got a degree in math.
Yeah.
So I was a super nerd. I'm still a super nerd. Anyway.
Nerds unite.
And.
In medical school.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's
a pretty expensive way to form a community, but hey. You know. One of the things I have heard is that one of the ways you get a leg up by being in a medical family is a connection to other people in medicine who can sort of help you with things like, you know, shadowing, clinical experiences, which are so important for medical school application. We talked about this on last week's show. So if you haven't heard that, go back and listen to it. But specifically about clinical experiences and the kinds that are good for you and not good for you. But did you find that you, I mean, did you take advantage of these opportunities? Was that?
Yeah, I did for shadowing. It was pretty easy in order to find shadowing because I was kind of doing it last minute in terms of trying to decide whether I want to do medicine my junior year. And so I was able to get all these opportunities lined up in a semester.
Pretty quickly.
I basically just shadowed a lot of my dad's friends. Yeah. So in that way, it was pretty easy. People who had respect for my dad too. And so a couple of them, I think I just called them up and then I came in like that week. So in that way, it was really nice.
What about you, Rob?
When it came to like experiences and stuff like that, I mean, because my parents aren't in medicine and right. I have an aunt that's married into the family. That's a family practice doc, but we don't really talk about medicine.
We don't really talk about her.
No. Yeah. She's great. She's great. I guess because I didn't have like that, those resources to like call on. I've never had shame in asking strangers for things.
Sure.
So I emailed somebody at Mercy Hospital when I was a freshman, and when I was there in the cath lab observing, I met this psychiatry family medicine resident here at the hospital, and then I ended up following him a couple different times. And like, I just, whenever I wanted to shadow somebody, I have no shame, and I would just email faculty directly and say I was interested. And I mean, it was just a lot more like putting myself out there. Like, I think I applied for like 35 lab jobs and got 2 interviews, and then the one that I ended up getting emailed me a year after I applied.
Oh, well.
So, things worked out. It just, there was never that guarantee that it was going to. It was just, you just put yourself out there and like, don't get your hopes up, and if things work, great.
Okay. Kylie, your early clinical experiences all probably revolved around scribing and that job that you did.
Or were you a scribe? Yeah. I didn't know that.
So I definitely, the only doctor I knew until the age of 20 was my childhood pediatrician. And, you know, it was kind of like when you're a little kid, oh, you want to be a doctor? That's cute. And then I just randomly applied to be a scribe at the end of my sophomore year of college. And then I met all those doctors, 13 male physicians in an ER. And I still kind of looked at them as like rock stars. I just idolized every doctor that I came in contact with and was like, wow, they're like real people and super cool. And maybe when I become a doctor, I'll be cool too. But definitely,
there's more to it than that.
You've realized you'll never be cool, right?
That's part of the problem now. But when I look around, even within medical school, and I like my friends, I'm like, I'm going to have friends that are doctors. That's so cool. I don't think it's clicked that I will be one of those doctors, or when we're in the bar, I mean,
well, we'll
studying
see.
In the library on Friday nights, and we're like looking around, I'm like, doctors do these kind of things? Like, I just feel so far removed from their lives, and seeing them as real people is still kind of a struggle.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was this idea that doctor parents usually or often say, no, you don't want to be a doctor. Don't do that. I was talking to one of your classmates today about what we were going to talk about. And he's like, yeah, my parents did not want me to go into medicine. They said you shouldn't go into medicine. And yet here he is.
PSA, there are way better ways to make more money.
Well, that's the, I think that's the crux of it. You know, he said back then you could make more money than you can now when you take into account, you know, loans and stuff like that. Did you guys get that sort of feedback from your parents, or was it just?
My parents were pretty supportive in that way. I mainly got it from physicians I shadowed. I don't know if you guys got that, but probably all but just a couple told me not to do medicine, not to go into the field they were in. But my siblings, I get it a little bit just because they're in the middle of residency and medical school, and so
nobody's gonna give you happy feedback.
Yeah, they haven't seen the fruits of it yet. Right. So, but not really for me.
You know, there are definitely parts, like, I think it strongly correlates with whether or not my mom was on call the previous night as to whether I got sort of negative feedback about going into medicine, or like now that I'm in medicine, she's like, you know, don't do, you know, surgery, or don't do critical care, you know, do dermatology, or do psychiatry, you know, or something like. You know, you don't want to be up in the middle of the night all the time. And
yeah.
And so that's been an interesting thing to hear. But you skipped over me going around earlier on that other question. I didn't actually really use like my mom's colleagues all that much. I think I shadowed one of them once, but I think I was also a paramedic student when I did that.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really tried hard not to go into medicine.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, life just sort of pulled me into it. One of my best friends in college was a paramedic. And when I needed a break, like, to get away from a terrible relationship I was in and all of the erudite, sophisticated equations and chalkboards, I went gravitated towards that. And then that just sort of pulled me in.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think everyone has that different story, you know, and I think it's cool to see that, like, how that comes to fruition, because in some ways, like, you know, a good mentor can do far more, you know, for you than a good connection in a, you know, family connection or something. Sure. Like, I am always very skeptical of my own potential to be like, you know, as a privileged individual to be like, oh, I didn't need that privilege to get to get where I am or have what I have. And so I like to be very skeptical of that. But I don't know. I mean, I've seen a lot of significant advantages to it, but I just The things about it that compelled me, the things about it that pulled me in, were much less about that and more about like my own innate skills. And in a sense, I think maybe that's part of where the heritability of medicine comes in. Like, I'm really interested in like interpersonal interaction. I'm really interested in, you know, intuitive problem solving. You kind of like look at it and you like know the answer. And that lends itself to like certain sets of problems in medicine, you know? And so like that does not lend itself well to being an accountant, right? Like where you have to actually like plan ahead and think through things and spend a lot of time like analyzing data by yourself or even, you know, law, for example. Yeah, there's a lot of interpersonal interaction potentially, but there's a huge amount of like sitting and reading and doing analysis of the law and doing analysis of the case and looking up and, you know, whereas I just basically like for the most part now just go talk to patients, think about them, like talk with my team, think about, you know, like, and it's just a very interpersonal interaction. And those things are very heritable. Like your personality is so heritable.
The reason one of the things that I want to bring up and is that, you know, so this is why I mentioned, you know, if you're from a medical family, you might have a leg up in terms of seeing what's possible for you. And if you come from a very disadvantaged background, that might be an impediment because you don't have those examples. In fact, we did a show earlier this fall with some pre-meds who were in the minority students club at the university. I think that's the right term. And so that was one of the things that we talked about on that show was, you know, coming from a, you know, relatively disadvantaged background, you might not, you might lack role models that will tell you or that will demonstrate to you that you can do this, that it's possible for you.
I think one of the biggest advantages that I equated with having doctor parents that now I realize is not exclusive to having parents that are doctors, but is the financial stability that comes with going to college. And even, you know, any of you who are applying to med school or have applied to med school know that the costs that you incur with that, traveling for interviews and those sorts of things. But it was just, you know, one thing after another. It was, you know, getting applications done, something breaks down on your like 15-year-old car. It was like always feeling like you didn't have a safety net to fall back into. And a lot of the students that maybe had college educated parents or doctor parents, I think kind of that envy of their stability and the financial aspects of those things. So,
but you have come to believe that that's not exactly the case. Is that what you said?
Well, I think it's true for,
because I wasn't listening,
for students whose parents are doctors. That was just always one of the careers that I think a lot of people equate with having a lot of money or making a lot of money. Whereas now, as I'm a little bit older, I see, okay, that's not an isolated event. A lot of people have really, you know, wealthy incomes and those sorts of things from other careers. But I think it's more a reflection of my background as being a first generation college student versus having parents that are doctors. Mm.
John, are you all right over there? Were you trying not to yawn?
No, it's just attack of the killer alopecia again.
Oh dear. I didn't realize it was a painful condition.
No, it's not painful. Eyes get really dry and I just attribute it to that. So
he was ejecting.
We have
a hair.
Some fiery Japanese eye drops, I'm sure, if you need.
Wait, do we still have those?
No, Doug took them back.
I want to shoot some eye drugs, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
Kylie, like I had forgotten like how much stress money caused me, like up until like, I mean, it can still, but like that, like, well, I guess like the second time I applied,
I'm right there with you, brother.
I applied three times, but the second time I applied, I was living in Chicago, and like, I don't know, it wasn't a cheap city. And then like, there's the cost of applications, and there was the cost of going to interviews, and just like, I knew I could, if I absolutely needed it, I could fall back on my parents. But like, I'm one of six kids, and like, my parents have their own financial things. I didn't want to dump on them, but like, that caused me a lot of stress at the time. And like after that second rejection, like, I'm like, do I really want to do this? Is it worth it? And I think that maybe like some added financial stability, knowing that like, oh, if I need to ask for help, like it will be, I can get it, no problem. Like that maybe would have eased the burden. I mean, it is what it is, and I survived.
I think you always find stuff to worry about though.
Yeah. It was more so that, you know, year than other years. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, your brain is really calibrated to optimize like misery. So like, because
that is what I find.
Because I definitely did have that financial stability, and I still struggled with a lot of other things, you know, and it might have just been the way my life story unfolded as a, you know, as a young adult. But that is something I don't want to take for granted, right? Like the fact that I, you know, I knew that to that extent I had the safety net. Yeah. Like that's for me, it's an opportunity to sort of pay it forward. And that's kind of part of what I look at. You know, we're so incredibly fortunate. Like I'm in the pediatric ICU now, you know, and every once in a while I look at the patients that I'm taking care of and I go, I mean, this is an incredible opportunity. Like these kids, you know, they would die if we didn't, and miserably if we weren't able to do that, to do what we do. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the opportunities to, you know, practice the medicine that we, you know, that we can. And I guess really what strikes me about it is that, like, for me, that's actually become part of my calling, is that notion that like, I didn't earn this. It was kind of handed to me. And that the best thing that I can do with that is to turn around and hand it out, you know, and that's, you know, like, the patients I care for, like, none of them asked to be, to have leukemia. Like, none of them asked to get a traumatic brain injury. But you, if you can use that as an opportunity, you know, use your privilege as an opportunity
to learn from it,
to learn, to share, to, explore, to learn, to teach. I mean, then that I think for me has been a big part of the calling, is recognizing that privilege and recognizing that, that's something that I hope, or I think, I imagine is kind of expected of us. But I don't know. I mean, American culture is really weird. I guess maybe my read is weird, but like a huge amount of what, you know, what was a successful part of Trump's narrative was sort of like, I win. I just take it. I get whatever I want and I take it. And I win the deal, you know, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, there was a big part of this narrative that was, you know, he said this constantly, like, we don't win enough in trade deals. You know, China is just steamrolling us.
Yeah,
like
this idea of a zero-sum game that there are winners and losers. And
right. When we trade, it's a mutual agreement. You know, I got awesome job offers, like with a bachelor's degree in math, that I could be doing now. And, you know, I would be like probably stacking money for some like hedge fund or something, but or designing weapon systems or espionage things, but
and in a sense you would be winning because you would be making money, you would be
right, and I
now
would
those,
work, but
that's
a
those
more,
are just hobbies for
yeah,
John
nor
now.
9 to 5 yeah that's I do my hacking and stuff on the side, guys.
Right,
consulting and all that, but yeah, but like I think that that's a real thing, like the ability to take that privilege that you have and sort of pay it forward.
I think like that your comments on American culture, I think that it's an aberration, really. I mean, despite like the advantages and disadvantages of all of us in this room, like we're all where we are because like literally thousands of people like helped us whether we know it or not. Mm-hmm. And that's true whether or not you want to believe it.
Right.
Yeah, you're not, your success is not
Not because of you.
It's not solely because of you.
You can take advantage of the opportunities you have and like put in your part, but like so much of it's not in your hands.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think my ego or my brain just sort of blew it more out of proportion, but I feel like it was a very big faux pas in part of the media that like they just reamed Obama for saying, like, he gave a speech and I think it might have been part of a State of the Union where he was like, you know, that there, you know, you didn't build that company, you didn't build that, and that, you know, it was all over Fox News and things like that, like how dare he.
Oh, yeah.
How dare he say, you know, I didn't make this company, I didn't earn this or whatever,
right?
But if you think about it, it's exactly what Rob said. Like, did you build all those roads that your successful shipping company daily relies on to make you piles of money, right? Like, did you teach all of those people how to read and write that, you know, work at your, you know, software company or whatever? Like, no, you know, you are absolutely relying on, you know, and I don't like that state of nature thing. Like, oh, every man for himself. You want to, like, we don't want to do that.
Yeah, we're not hunters and gatherers. We haven't been for a little while now.
I'm sure even hunters and gatherers depended on each other for hunting and gathering, right?
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed that both of you said was that like you both tried not to go into medicine, and then ended up happening, but you ended up choosing to go into medicine. And I remember like as far back as seventh grade, like I found this writing about how I wanted to be a doctor, and like and I thought I wanted to be a doctor, and so I chose a major that would make me. That would prepare me for medical coursework, and I ended up taking the MCAT 3 times and ended up applying to medical school 3 times, and then I ended up like coming off the wait list 23 spots down the thing. And so like there's a little bit like where it's a podcast so you can't see anything, but like I kind of want to roll my eyes like when you're like, oh, I tried not to do it, but it happened.
Yeah, well,
and it's not like me because I do recognize that like a lot of it is luck and what happened. But there's, I put a lot of effort and like very much tried for a very long time to be here. And so I'm just like, yeah.
I guess I missed that point. That's really funny. Like, well, I got into med school. I didn't even try.
No, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you didn't try. Yeah. We all worked really hard to be here, but like, I never tried not to be in med school.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to be something else, and Jesus, I found myself in med school.
At the what same do you time, know? When we get to weird. Med school, whether you adopt your parents or not, the material's hard.
Sure,
and
sure,
there's
sure.
a lot of it and that sort of thing. But sometimes I think back to, or, you know, you come across studies that kids who grow up with college-educated parents or parents who have an idea about what the field is, you just have more opportunities afforded to you at a younger age, and your development just takes a different path. So things might always be a little bit easier for you. And I'm not saying this is for specifically for myself, but even for applicants who English was their second language in the home and things like that, that give you a unique pathway to get here and may always keep things a little bit more challenging in school. And that by no means that you can't, means by no means that you can't.
It means by no means.
Yes. Achieve at the same potential as your peers. But just know that it's privileged to be here, and you can work to accomplish the exact same things, but you might have to work a little harder.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, even remotely say that, you know, the privilege means nothing, right? And that was my shorthand version of what you were saying, Dave, is that, like, right. It doesn't make a difference. And I don't agree with that at all. I think we can think of it as a, you know, as sort of a numbers game. It's like you need the right numbers to show up on the dice. Now, if you came from a well-to-do, well-connected doctor family with lots of financial, you know, advantages, your dice may be a little bit loaded. You may get, a few sort of, you may have to pay less per roll, you know, et cetera, right? But you still have to roll the right numbers, but it's all about, you know, if you really work hard and you don't have those advantages, you can still roll the right numbers, but you're going to have to roll a lot more times. Yeah. So that's like the way that I think about, you know, your effort and your skill and your luck. They all sort of have to pool together. And some of us have, you know, more skill and luck than others. And some of us, have had to work a lot harder for it. And so I guess what I was trying to say is that it's not that one is better than the other per se, but I recognize
I'm better than you, John. Yeah. Let's just put that on the table.
I'm just not trying to make it to pass a judgment on that, because I think if you hold it in the right way, that you can get a different perspective from any route.
I think, like, for the most part, like, I got the sense once, like when we all showed up and 1 year, like, you couldn't always pick out when people had parents that were physicians, but like I guess certain ways things were said could be telling. Just I don't know, like.
Well, when my dad went to Carver College of Medicine, it's very subtle.
To be very hyperbolic, yeah. but like, I got the sense that we were all kind of on equal footing once we got here. And there's people who have parents that are doctors who have done very well, and there's people that don't have parents that are doctors that have also done very well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, I think, like, there are different roads to get here, some more challenging than others. But then, like, once you're here, and that's, by and large, like, the playing field's level.
And I think if you flipped it, like, we've talked about it a lot in the context of coming into medical school and the differences or similarities between students in a class. But I think it's a big difference when you leave. And so Adam going home to his family, who knows what's going on and stuff, like, how many times do you get asked a question of, like, what might this weird, like, medical thing be? I have this rash or things like that. Whereas when I go home, I'm like, I've done one semester of medical school, and someone in my family will be like, there's this obscure, like, disorder, and what can you tell me about it? just kind of trying to fit back into that environment. And do you feel like there's less pressure since everyone else knows what's going on to, like, converse with your family about med school?
Like, less pressure to act like you know what you're talking about, you mean?
Yeah, or... you know what you're talking about, or, like, since it's a part of their daily lives, that you don't have to talk about it all the time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They understand.
I probably don't
want
to talk about it.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it either. But
Adam learned vital signs this semester. Big deal.
Especially my brothers who are residents. I mean, their few hours that they have at home, the last thing they want to do is talk about work, especially because they're in neurosurgery. So often it's very heavy what's going on at work, and they want it to be more lighthearted when they're at home. So no, and of course they don't ask me any questions about.
You don't get pimped at the dinner table.
Yeah, they're not like, Adam, I got this patient today. Could you help me out with a diagnosis? Yeah, that never happens.
Yeah, because it's like over Christmas break, I think at least a dozen times I had to get asked about, like, how long is medical school and what is the residency? And at some point you're just like, oh, man.
If anything, I feel like I have to hide the fact that there's still a lot I don't know about the next step, you know, because it's like, I don't want to sound stupid, but I really don't know that much about residency, you know, and they're in it. And so then it seems like ignorant to.
Well, they didn't know either, believe me.
Yeah. But
as an M1, they had no effing clue.
Yeah. So if anything, that happens.
Listeners, if there's something you want to say about what we've talked about today. Give us a holler, shortcode.com/tell us. Biology. It's complicated. It's very complicated.
Yes.
Fortunately.
Dave's about to give us the sex talk.
Fortunately, Twitter brings us the ability to ask biologists burning questions if you happen to have them. This past week, a doctoral candidate with the Institute of Zoology at the Zoological Society of London realized he didn't know the answer to a crucial question. Do snakes fart? So he consulted the literature. I'm just kidding. He tweeted at another biologist, David Steen, an assistant research professor at the Auburn University Museum of Natural History in Alabama. Spoiler alert, snakes do fart. So put that to rest. But what happened was Nicholas Caruso, another PhD candidate at the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alabama, decided he'd seen this fart question before in relation to other animals. So he brought forth the hashtag Does it fart on Twitter? And that resulted ultimately in a spreadsheet of animals that fart and don't fart.
Is this a government funded database?
I don't think so. I think it's a Google. I think it's a Google spreadsheet.
All right.
Just looking at the raw data. New.
Shout out to the person that put in the giraffe entry. It's like giraffe next column. Does it fart? Hell yes, in all caps. And then it's like optional info, farts at the height of a grown man's head. And I want to know the story behind that one.
It turns out that some animals don't fart, which I'm surprised at because I figured, you know, digestion or whatever.
Everybody does it.
No, ladies don't fart.
Oh.
Mussels, ammonites, common whelks, oysters, softshell clams, anemones, shore crabs. They don't fart.
Pretty much everything I don't eat.
I mean, this is basically, would you expect a jellyfish to fart?
Yeah.
I mean,
how do you think it propels itself?
In some way.
Have you seen SpongeBob?
I mean, basically, like, think of bacteria. Bacteria don't fart. They don't have an anus, basically.
But bacteria aren't
animals.
But
they ferment.
But they do emit gases. I mean, that's why we fart, right? So they're kind of farting. All we're doing when we fart is farting somebody else's fart.
What?
Colony of bacteria's will.
I mean, basically, because bacteria are inside you farting, and so you fart. Right?
I don't know. I don't like this definition of farting.
I don't
farting.
Know if you call bacteria like just forming gas.
I just want to say fart roughly 600 times.
Well, you did manage to fit in the word anus, so that's like two for two between this week last week.
Birds apparently don't fart either.
Birds are great. Oh. Birds are all full of all sorts of weird physiology. You know when you get bird poop on your car?
Mm-hmm.
Does that white pasty stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes there's maybe
urea.
Like a greenish or like a black part.
Wait, doesn't yours look like that too?
Usually. But the white pasty stuff is actually bird urine.
Oh, well, because they...
It's urea.
Yeah. So they excrete... well, it's more uric acid because it's a paste.
All right.
But they actually excrete their nitrogenous waste. They're so good at concentrating the water out of their food that they actually excrete solid urine.
This is a really bitter topic for me because some bird just like shit its brains out on my bedroom window of my third story apartment. And it's like not average bird poop. It's,
you're going to have to look at that for a while.
It's like, yeah, it's roughly the size of a Thanksgiving turkey on my bedroom
window. And it's
window.
Not, and it's, is your window not openable? Like no. you can't.
No, it's just there.
Now you got to call your landlord and have some weird conversation. It's not right.
You know what you should do? You should get like a wax pencil or something like, and draw on the inside of your window, like little legs maybe, and like a little thought bubble, and you can like, you can make it into like the fun bird poop that's on your window. Like,
yeah.
You know, turn it into a little person or a little animal. You can like give it little horns or a little mustache.
Oh my God. I am trying so desperately
Please
right now
this.
To procrastinate from studying neuroanatomy. I might go home and make a shit little creature on my window.
Please do this.
I think this is like its own built-in like Instagram.
Yes.
Thing.
Yeah. Okay, we'll put it up
it
on
could
the
become
podcast
a list,
webpage.
There'll be like a listicle that you'll be included on eventually.
Oh, by the way,
the 34 best bird poop on window people ideas
this is of all time.
This could
take
BuzzFeed.
Life goal to make it on BuzzFeed.
Trending on Instagram.
I would click that on
Can
Facebook.
Can you trend on Instagram?
Came up
I don't know. Strangely, no one knows if spiders fart, I noticed.
Spiders' legs are farting.
What?
They open
they
you,
do,
if you kill a spider
things.
If you kill a spider you notice their legs all curl up.
We should,
it's water.
We should add in
they,
John has small kids at home, so
yeah,
he just
so,
yells things.
Yeah, so spiders'
spider
legs
fart.
they curl up because they're held by tension.
Mm-hmm.
They're like sort of like rubber bands to pull them inward, and then they use hydraulic pressure to push them out.
Yeah.
So when they die, that hydraulic pressure is removed and they just curl in.
Or if they're just dehydrated. Sometimes a curled up spider could be alive if it's just dehydrated.
Oh,
so.
Worst fears confirmed.
Yeah.
Do you get a glass of water then?
Yeah, I don't know.
What do you do?
Give
it's
it a tiny little bit of water.
The lesser known sequel.
Put it in the toilet.
Book. You give a mouse a cookie, you give a spider a glass of water.
You nurse it back to health with little drops of water on the end of like a mechanical pencil or something.
Quit. Get a fine tipped pipette. The spider's thirsty.
A 2003 study determined that herring use farts to communicate with each other.
Herrings.
It's like me and my brothers.
They use the sound of the bubbles to form protective shoals at night. So basically, it's like, oh, I found a nice place over here. Come and hang out. Scientists call the sound of a herring fart an FRT, or fast repetitive tick.
Why wouldn't they just add the A in the acronym?
I think they were. I don't know. They were messing with us. Basically, I'm pretty sure. It has a high pitch up to 22 kilohertz, and it's not from digestion. Actually, it's from the swim bladder. The air from the swim bladder comes in when they gulp it at the surface, and then they...
That's just an ornate burp.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a fart.
Liars.
An ornate
that's
burp.
Not a,
if
it, that's not a fart at all.
If it hasn't touched your poop, it's not a fart.
Well, it does come from the it does come from the anal tube, though, so...
That's one of the criteria you need to fulfill in our definition of fart.
Yeah, guys, we have like a four-step process. You have to achieve a level at each of those steps to be qualified as a fart. We're fartologists here.
Dave,
I'm gonna have to look at my qualifications.
Should we take to Twitter with the hashtag does it shart? start a more in-depth
nice.
Analysis.
If the shart can't come from that location, then the fart can't come
if
from
the
that
shart
location.
Came from the swim bladder, it's not a real shart.
Well, I should probably not use the word shart on the podcast. My mom really doesn't like it. She prefers that we say foop.
Poop.
A fart poop.
That's weird.
Foop.
Intestinal gas, and here's another tidbit, intestinal gas in rabbits can kill them.
What?
It's called, it causes something called intestinal stasis if they get too much gas, and it can make them die.
Rabbits are just so ill prepared for life.
Yeah.
Like they're such a good example of how...
How are there so many of them?
Of how blind evolution is. Like one of their more recent ancestors is a carnivore, and if you look at their like ontologically, like you look at their intestinal tract, they definitely look like the intestinal tract of an animal that eats meat. And they're so inefficient at eating like grass and the things that they eat that they have to eat it once, poop it out, eat it again. then they can digest it.
Ugh, sounds this like is... my vegan friends.
Exactly.
It's one of those topics where I'm like, why the hell does John know so much about this?
But the cool thing about why are there so many rabbits, the reason there are so many rabbits is they actually ovulate upon having sex.
Oh.
So
well, that's convenient.
That is,
I know.
Fast.
From like
nightmare.
A success rate efficient. Perspective.
Yeah, right? You're like, you're they're effectively always in heat then. Okay. Just
man.
Well, there, I think we've all learned something here today. Yeah.
I did have one issue with the list.
Rob's
why?
Vegan friends eat their own shit.
Not my vegan friends.
Oh, I thought you said
all vegans.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, haven't you ever had tofu? Come on.
You put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Oh, boy. Once again, the conversation has devolved.
Devolved.
Wait, what were you going to say?
My issue with this list is, why do birds not fart, but lizards on the list, which is a reptile, so an evolutionary ancestor, does fart? So why would birds lose farting?
Because it's no longer evolutionary advantageous. Okay.
Well birds, you won't die because you fart.
Perhaps birds hold it in and it helps them be more buoyant in the air.
But
I was having that thought.
But
I like that.
The
like
ability
that.
To fart is not crucial for survival.
Clearly.
And
which is why
as,
they just
as Darwin said, if you don't use it, you lose it. So they lost their ability to fart.
Thanks, Darwin. You know, this actually does remind me. It takes us back to our previous conversation. This is one of the joys
the substantive
of having
one.
This is the one of the joys of having a doctor parent in my family. Oh, so my mom is a pediatrician. So there's like one of the chief concerns of pediatrics is constipation.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of my mom's day, I think, or at least an appreciable part, revolves around constipation and or pooping. And so we had a scoring system at dinner. For assigning points to the frequency and intensity with which my mom brought up stooling during dinner. So like, did she would routinely, I think it was basically every night, would mention stooling in one way or another during dinner.
Did she call it stooling?
Yeah, poop, whatever. Oh, okay. I mean, I'm just being technical.
No,
about
that. That's fine. We need more of that.
Defecation, fecalization.
We're all about keeping it classy on the short coat.
Yeah, exactly.
I got yelled at the dinner table by my mom as a child because I referred to the steak as good cow. So our dinner conversations were different than yours.
Yeah, I always called, are we having dead chicken for dinner? my grandparents still call it like dead. We're having dead chicken or dead turkey or like whatever
you,
we're eating.
Oh boy, you got to come over to my house. We have live chicken for dinner.
What the hell?
Wow. Oh. Well,
it's pretty brutal.
On that note,
would you say that this episode's going to end with a whimper?
I don't know. Well,
or a growl.
Let's just say that that's our show.
Now.
I think technically that was a fart.
That's our show, guys.
Well, I can make good farting sounds with my hands. Here.
That's not getting on.
I
did hear that.
Guys, that sounds like a herring fart.
Just for your information, she is not using her hands right now.
That's our show, guys. Thank you, Kylie, Adam, Rob, John. Appreciate your help with these many important topics that we've discussed today. And thank you, listeners, for making us a part of your week. If you like what you heard today, consider sharing it with your colleagues. If you have a suggestion, you may not have colleagues after that. If you have a suggestion for something we should talk about, send it to theshortcoats@gmail.com or to 347-SHORT-CT. And like our Facebook page, where every week I ask listeners to send in their comments on allegedly profound things. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by Argo Fox. Talk to you in 1 week.